This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoen in for Terry Gross. Before too long, you'll begin to notice the skies filling with birds making their way south to warmer climates. Scientists and birdwatchers have always been impressed with birds' ability to fly thousands of miles each spring and fall against headwinds, against the odds, and with few hospitable resting areas along the way. My guest, Scott Wiedenthal, is a birder and nature writer who has just written a book about the complexity and wonders of avian migration. Living on the Wind is about how and why and where birds migrate, and the biology of migration that still confounds scientists. Scott Wiedenthal leads guided natural history tours, and he bans hawks and owls in the mountains of eastern Pennsylvania. He writes the Nature Watch column for the Philadelphia Inquirer and also writes for Smithsonian Magazine and other publications. His book, Living on the Wind, includes maps of migration routes. I asked him if birds really follow a specific route when they migrate.
There are very definite routes that some of these species take, and they're not accidental. They're shaped by landforms. They're shaped by water barriers, and particularly shaped by wind patterns. You find that even with species like short-tailed shearwaters, which nest on the islands off Tasmania, travel completely around the Pacific Rim and spend the summer in the Bering Strait feeding. They follow a fairly precise route in this figure eight back to Tasmania, and they arrive back in Tasmania at a rate of about 20,000 per hour within the same 10 or 12-day period every year, right before the breeding season starts again. So these birds are not just global commuters, but they're doing it on a very tight schedule.
Well, what is it that activates this migratory impulse? And I was actually curious to read that a lot of these questions are really unanswered, they're not complete answers.
We do know that it's not what people assume. It's not cold weather coming on. It's not hunger that triggers this. Most of the birds start migrating in the fall before the weather gets cold, and they migrate when they're at their fattest, so one assumes that they're not particularly hungry right then. What seems to be the trigger is the changing amount of daylight and sunlight, what's called the photoperiod. In the spring, the days are getting longer, and that triggers changes in the bird's hormones, and that sets off these urges. None of this is a conscious decision. The bird doesn't get up in the morning and say, oh, yeah, I'm getting tired of Guatemala. I think it's time to go back to Ontario. Their strings are being jerked, essentially, by hormonal changes that they have no control over. And many of these birds, especially in the fall, these are birds that have never been to where they're going. These are young birds that have just hatched. Their parents abandoned them a long time ago.
They're on their own.
They don't travel in family groups, with the exception of a few groups like ducks and geese and cranes. Almost all other birds travel alone or in flocks of the same age. So you get this young bird that's only out of the nest 6 weeks, and it has this overwhelming compulsion to head in a certain direction at a certain time of the year for a certain length of time. And all of that is genetically encoded.
So you're talking about a, quote, urgency to fly. You even talk about a blind faith. I mean, of course, that's a human being writing about it.
But
it is, if they're covering 10,000 miles, there is a certain kind of blind faith.
Exactly. The bird doesn't know where it's going or how it's going to get there or what it's going to find when it arrives. It just knows that it has to do it. You can take a bird, and people notice this as far back as the Middle Ages, in Europe, when they would catch these songbirds like linnets and nightingales and would put them in a cage, and come fall, when the days were getting shorter, the birds would get very agitated and they'd hop in a certain direction. They'd keep banging against the bars of the cage on the southern part of the cage. And that's known as premigratory restlessness. And they get more and more restless until one day they can't stand it anymore and they start flying in that direction.
Hmm. Kind of like spring fever, I guess.
Human equivalent. Comes twice a year. They get fall fever as well as spring fever.
Who would you say is the most sort of impressive migrator? Perhaps it's maybe the tiniest or the longest trip, the most arduous journey that you've seen.
There's two. There's a little tiny bird called a black pole warbler. It weighs less than half an ounce. You could mail two of these things anywhere in the country for a 33-cent stamp.
Less than half an ounce?
Less than half an ounce. It's about 4 inches long. And, of course, most of that is feather. Black pole warblers breed across New England and Canada and Alaska in the boreal forest zone, in the spruce forest zones. And let's just, for the sake of argument, take a black pole warbler that hatches in extreme western Alaska. Now, instead of taking the logical route due south, this bird will actually fly east across all of Canada for 2,000 or 3,000 miles until it reaches a staging area in the Canadian Maritimes and along the New England coast. And some of those birds in the fall come as far south as Pennsylvania. And they're waiting there for a big cold front, big strong weather system to come through with strong northwest winds. And again, instead of then turning and flying south over what we would think of as safe land, these birds follow the winds out to sea, out to the Atlantic Ocean, and the wind carries them for hundreds of miles out over the western Atlantic, and they sort of slowly start to curve back. When they get over about Bermuda, the wind starts to fail, and they start picking up the northeasterly trade winds that are coming in. That kind of curves them back in toward land, so they're coming in over the Lesser Antilles, 4, 5, 6,000 feet up. You can see them on weather radars, these little greenish blobs going over. And then they start to drop down toward the northeastern coast of South America. It's about an 80-hour trip, and of course, they're doing this without rest, without food, without water. They're beating their wings about 4 or 5 million times during the course of this 80 hours. I've heard it described as somebody running 4-minute miles for, you know, 2.5 or 3 days. Imagine the kind of exertion that calls for, and an animal that's not a whole lot bigger than, you know, two of your fingers put together.
But what it's doing, though, is hopping the winds. I mean, I would assume for a lot of birds that that's going to be one of the ways that they're going to get accelerated to their destination.
Exactly. And you asked about another migrant, and one that's only just come to light in the last 2 years that depends on winds utterly for its migration, is the bar-tailed godwit, which breeds in western Alaska. It's a shorebird. The body's about the size of a pigeon, but it's got this, you know, long, skinny legs and this long ice pick of a bill. And in September, these birds gather on the shores of the Alaskan Peninsula, and they feed on little tiny clams in the tidal flats until they are 55% fat. This is the fattest wild birds that have ever been found. And then their entire digestive system shrinks down to almost nothing. It just atrophies. The stomach shrivels. The intestines shrink down. The kidneys go kaput on them. The liver shrinks, sheds all this extra weight, and they wait for these big gales that come out of the Aleutians with like 80, 90-mile-an-hour winds. And when the wind direction shifts to the right compass point as the storm passes, all these godwits take off and they fly directly out into the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and they get this slingshot effect for about 1,500 miles from the wind. Now, we don't know if, as they're flying along, if they're flying at their normal airspeed, which is about 60 or 70 miles an hour. They're very fast birds. So if you add 60 and 70 miles an hour to the 80 or 90 mile an hour winds, or if they scale back their effort to try to conserve energy, scientists are still working on this. But these birds make a 6,800 mile nonstop flight directly across the widest part of the Pacific Ocean. They don't stop in Hawaii. They don't stop in French Polynesia. They don't stop anywhere along the way. They finally come for a landing in New Zealand and Australia, where they promptly regrow their entire digestive system and start feeding again.
Boy, they talk about the adaptation, right, and evolution
staggering.
At work.
Absolutely staggering. I mean, to think that a system like that would even work once in a while, much less work year after year for the vast majority of that species.
Well, that's why you say migration is not for the faint-hearted.
That's
right?
True.
you got to be ready for that. One of the scientists that you quote saying, in terms of talking about an impressive biology, that if we were to take a birds on migration, these sort of equivalent miles per hour in our sort of gallon mentality would be something like 250,000 miles. Per gallon, right?
Well, actually, I think the figure actually was like 720,000 miles per gallon if they were burning gasoline instead of fat, because you're talking about, in some of these small birds, they're crossing the Western Atlantic or the Gulf of Mexico on 2 or 3 grams of fat. Hmm. You could put 2 or 3 grams of fat on the end of your index finger and have room left for more.
And that's why this migration is so important to try to understand.
Absolutely.
Because it gives you a little snapshot into how a system works.
Absolutely.
One of the things that you talk about and you mentioned earlier was that the birds sort of noticed the light change, and that seems to activate this migratory response. But you also seem to say that there's some sense of the Earth's magnetic field,
sure,
low-frequency sound waves, that all these things are sort of working on a bird's system.
Right. The changing daylight and darkness, that's what triggers the migration. But, you know, just because the bird's up and flying, it still has to know where it's going. It has to pick a direction. And there are actually two tasks that the bird has to do. One is orientation. It has to know basically where's north, where's south, what are the cardinal points. And then it also has to navigate, which means it has to know where it is in relation to the landscape. we have a pretty good notion of how birds orient themselves. It appears that the two most important cues for them are celestial landmarks. A lot of these birds fly at night, even songbirds that are normally active by day. So they're using the rotation of stars around Polaris. So not looking up and saying, oh, well, there's Cassiopeia, now I have to make a left. They're just sort of aware of the rotation that shows them where north is. And they're also very sensitive, as you said, to the Earth's magnetic field, which is extremely faint. And there's some concern that as we put more and more electromagnetic radiation into the environment, that may have an effect on birds. That hasn't been shown yet experimentally, but there's some concern about that. But they also use, as you said, extremely low frequency sound. Some species of birds apparently navigate by using smell. Most birds have a poor sense of smell, but many seabirds have a good sense of smell. Homing pigeons in some areas seem to use smell. They use landmarks. As they get older and get to know the area that they're returning to, they'll obviously use visual cues. How they navigate, though, there's not nearly as much information on that. It appears that much of it is just genetically encoded, what's called a time-distance program, where the bird has an instinctive urge to fly in a certain direction for a certain length of time, certain period of days, and then it will change its orientation and fly in a somewhat different direction. It's kind of like if you were ever in Scouts, you're running an orienteering course with a compass. You're given a set of directions. Go 115 degrees for 15 steps, turn 114, you know, and you can work out this complicated route even though you don't know where the end is. And it seems that that's how birds are navigating extremely long distances.
Well, it's interesting to think, and again, this is using a sort of a human word, but how they, you know once they've gotten to where they want to go,
right.
How do they know that they're there?
Well, yeah, that's a real good question, and we don't know. There's been some... It was always assumed that as birds, when a young bird arrived, say, in the tropics, a bird that was hatched in northern Canada arrives in the tropical rainforest or in a pine oak forest in the highlands of Mexico, how would it know the right habitat? And it was always assumed they kind of wandered around until they found the right spot. Well, they've been doing research that shows, no. They arrive and bam, they're in exactly where they need to be. And how they're doing that is a mystery to me.
Well, I was surprised to read, and I don't know whether you were surprised to find, that most birds migrate at night. Or a lot of birds. I mean, I think that the feeling is, and perhaps here in the Delaware Valley, you know, it's fall, you look up, and there are the geese,
there
you know,
go the geese
heading south.
Exactly, or the flocks of robins, which are among the relatively few diurnal migrants, daytime migrants. The vast majority of songbirds, many waterfowl, many shorebirds, all migrate at night. And the reason they do it seems to be that the night is a more favorable medium for them. The air is less turbulent. It's cooler, it's moister, because a lot of these birds, their real danger is not exhaustion or lack of food, but that they're going to dehydrate because they're losing so much moisture as they're breathing. There are fewer predators to worry about after dark.
Is it quieter at dark?
It's somewhat quieter, and of course, then they have also the advantage of using celestial navigation. So when you look, you can actually log on the internet now on some of the NEXRAD Doppler radar sites and click on clear air reflectivity, which I have no idea what that means, but that's the radar setting that ornithologists are using. You can actually see these flocks of birds moving across the landscape, particularly as they're crossing the Gulf of Mexico, where you get these enormous fallouts of you know, birds arriving at a rate of hundreds of thousands per mile of beach per hour, and you get these great blossoms of color on the radar screen of red and orange and blue as these enormous, you know, millions of birds crossing and making landfall. And it's all happening often under the cover of darkness, and people have no clue as to what's going on over their heads.
What percentage of birds don't make it? And is this the sort of, you know, survival of the species
Absolutely.
At work? If you can't make it from,
it's a winnowing,
you know, Alaska
process.
To Guatemala, mm-hmm. you ain't going to make it.
It's a winnowing process generation after generation. And in some cases, probably about 70% of the birds that are hatched each year don't make it to their first birthday.
70%. And they don't make it in this migratory run.
Well, they don't make it during that period. But, of course, migration winnows out a great many of them.
I'll talk more with birder and nature writer Scott Wiedenthal about bird migration after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with nature writer and birder Scott Wiedenthal. His new book is called Living on the Wind. I asked him about how development, suburban sprawl, and highways are affecting the habitats of migrating birds.
It's definitely having an impact on migratory behavior. You have to think of migration as a web, as a global web, or a chain in which every link is just important as every other link. And what we're doing with our development and our changes in the environment is breaking those links. And we're not doing it intentionally. We're doing it frequently without giving a thought to what the consequences are. And so you have a bird that has just passed the winter in along the Gulf Coast or down in Central or South America, and it flies back to its nesting site from the previous year and discovers that what used to be a nice tangle of oak and hickory is now oak forest estates, and it's been chopped up into pieces. And even if they can find a place, let's say you're a wood thrush and you're looking for a fairly large tract of woodland in which to nest, you build your nest. Well, now there are houses nearby, there are cats, but there are also natural predators that thrive around disturbed habitats, like raccoons and possums, blue jays, grackles, all of which feed on eggs and chicks. There are also brown-headed cowbirds, which are a native species that will throw out the eggs of the host bird and lay their own eggs in its place. And the parasitism rates on these many wood thrush nests in particular are extremely high. This is a bird that the wood thrush never had to worry about back in the days when eastern North America was a pretty much solid blanket of forest, because the cowbird is found mostly in open habitats. But as we fragmented the breeding grounds, it's made life very, very difficult for some of these birds.
But how fragmented can it be before it really has an impact on migration?
Depends on the bird. We don't know that yet. And there's a lot of really frantic work going on right now by ornithologists and other field biologists trying to learn the answers to that. Some birds can do very well in fragmented habitat. It just depends on the species. I mean, there are migratory birds that like robins, for example, are a migratory bird. Well, no one can argue that development has been bad for robins. They're one of the most abundant species in North America. The conservation community has been doing in recent years is assessing all the different threats that apply to each bird at each point in its life cycle and trying to gauge which of those species are at higher risk. It's what's known as the watch list. And so you have a species like a robin that has a relatively short distance migration, a wide range, and is rather eclectic in its habitat choices. That's a very low-risk species. You get a bird like a cerulean warbler, which nests in eastern North America. It prefers very large, unbroken tracts of forest. It has a very long migration. It travels down to the foothills of the Andes, so it has all the risks that are attendant with long migration. And it winters in a very narrow altitudinal band in the Andes, only about a 2,000-foot elevation. And it just happens to be the elevation that's perfect for growing coca for cocaine and has the most valuable hardwood forests in South America. So it's getting walloped at every point of its life cycle. That's a very high-risk species. And so conservation efforts and research are focusing on species like that.
You also write about the fact that the overpopulation of deer has had an impact on the forest and the undergrowth, and that is having a kind of a domino effect on bird migration.
It sure is. That's been a long-standing problem and one that's only recently been getting a lot of attention. I live up in Schuylkill County, up in the mountains, and our deer populations up there are probably average about 25 to 35 deer per square mile. But when you get into more suburban areas where there's less deer hunting, the deer populations in some places are 70, 80 deer per square mile. And anything above about 15 deer per square mile has a real impact on the forest. The deer feed very heavily on the underbrush and on the lower branches of the trees. It's kind of like they've eaten the middle out of the sandwich. And so species like indigo buntings and oven birds and wood thrushes that nest in that from the ground up to about 15 or 20 feet high lose their habitat for nesting. And it's had really devastating impacts on birds, not just in Pennsylvania. I mean, deer overpopulation is a problem just about everywhere that white-tailed deer live.
Are you optimistic that, in 100 years we'll have the variety of birds that we have today? Or
well,
are
no,
the threats to...
There's no future in pessimism, so I try to keep myself optimistic. We're certainly going to lose some. We're going to lose some species. We're going to lose some migrations. But the thing that makes me hopeful is that we now recognize what's at stake. And I think people understand, for the most part, even if they're not birders, that there's this thing that goes on that's much bigger than them, that's much bigger than us as a species, that adds immeasurably to the world. I mean, who doesn't thrill in the fall to standing outside and hearing a flock of migrant Canada geese going over high overhead, or seeing the first robin in the springtime? It adds a great deal to our world.
Scott Wiedenthal is a birder and bander. His new book is Living on the Wind. I'm Marty Moscoane, and this is Fresh Air.